This is a Connectability radio production.
The Shared Learning Forum series of workshops brought to you by Connectability.ca and DSTO.com. Understanding Capacity, Competency, and Consent with Elaine Acheson, the Ministry of Attorney General, Ontario. Part 2, Personal Care.
It's my pleasure to introduce to you our speaker today, Elaine Acheson. Elaine is the Program Coordinator for the Capacity Assessment Office, the Ministry of Attorney General. She is a registered nurse with experience in psychiatric and psychogeriatric nursing. As a psychiatric advocate, she learned to work with legislation, specifically the Mental Health Act, and she developed an ongoing interest in patient rights and issues of autonomy and capacity. In 1995, Elaine was employed as a treatment decisions consultant for the Office of the Public Guardian and Trustee, making last resort treatment decisions under the Health Care Consent Act. As Senior Program Coordinator now for the Capacity Assessment Office, she provides training and consultation to capacity assessors who have qualified under the Substitute Decision Act of 1992 to carry out legal assessments of capacity for property and personal care pursuant to that act.
So who is designated under the legislation to do these assessments? We're going to start with the Health Care Consent Act. It applies to any treatment facility. Okay, it applies to people living at home who have health care plans because their doctor says you need this diet and you need these medications and you need to get your blood work checked every 3 months because of these medications or this condition. That's a health care plan. Okay, and so they need to be able to consent to it. And the person who determines whether they're able to consent or not is any one of the regulated health professionals. There's 22 of them in Ontario. If you're a dentist or a chiropractor, a nurse, a social worker, an occupational therapist, a physiotherapist, a physician, a surgeon, if you can propose treatment, you have the obligation to determine whether or not the person's capable of making an informed decision. Okay, so it's the person proposing treatment who must determine capacity to say yes or no to that treatment. Under the Health Care Consent Act, there was also a decision in recognition of the growing number of elderly in our population. There was a growing need to identify a mechanism so the issue about when is it time for an elderly person to move to a nursing home, because they now have care needs such that they cannot be safely managed at home, either because they now require 24/7 care, or because they've had a stroke and it requires a two-person lift to even turn them in bed. And for most of us, the resource issues. How much can you afford to provide your own home care? How much do you need? And again, for people who require treatments like dialysis or other fairly complex treatments, how much family support is there? Are they prepared to learn how to do this and to monitor it and keep you at home? Or do you need to be moved to some place that can provide it? And it's very specific to nursing homes. Things that are defined as nursing homes within the legislation in Ontario, they're government-controlled, they're government-run. They have rules they must follow and standards of practice they must abide by. And they have a care component included in the room and board charges that they ascribe. Compared to retirement homes, which are strictly room and board and fall under the Landlord-Tenant Act, and have no requirement to provide a nurse around the clock or assistance with medication. Those things in retirement home are not a requirement of the retirement home contract, and they're often add-ons that people purchase and pay for over and above the cost of room and board. So we're only talking about long-term care admission. The Act created these seven professionals, and the Act says these professionals have the skills to conduct interviews to listen to whether the person has been able to take in the information about the fact they've had a stroke, for instance, and that stroke has now caused them to have a paralysis on their left side, and what that means in terms of not just functional ability, but their ability to plan for how they can get their care needs met safely at home. They need to be educated first. Most people, again, If you're not in the healthcare field, things like community care access center or CCACs, people, the average Joe on the street who's never run into this has never heard of it. So there's an obligation to educate always. It's always about not testing for ignorance, but testing for the ability to take information in, process it, retain it, and apply it then to your situation. Very deliberately, these assessments are conducted by people who are usually working in systems. They're in hospitals, healthcare clinics, wherever, and they're being paid by the government, either under OHIP or some other scheme. So the cost of assessment is not borne by the client or by the family. So what do we mean by treatment? The definition is part one of the Health Care Consent Act. It's important to know what does require informed consent, because anything that is defined as treatment requires informed consent by a capable person. Okay, so the therapeutic, preventative, palliative, diagnostic, cosmetic, or other health-related purposes. You have to be capable to get a facelift, or your substitute has to give consent to it. And I've talked about plans of care. People with complex needs, more than one issue, may have care needs that are, you know, run a gamut of things, but they're ongoing care needs. This isn't likely to change. Somebody with a blood pressure problem needs to have the blood pressure monitor and take medication. Okay, so the taking of the blood pressure is part of the care plan. These are things that don't require informed consent. If you go to the doctor because you think something's wrong, he does need informed consent to put the stethoscope on or check your chest or wrap your knees with a reflex hammer. He's assessing. He's trying to figure out what's wrong. Okay, and to do that basic trying to determine what's wrong, the basic assessment, doesn't require informed consent. He doesn't know where he's going until he finds something. He's not ready to propose a treatment because he doesn't know what's wrong yet. But the process of finding out what's wrong doesn't require informed consent. Supposedly you walk through the door and kept the appointment. There's an implied call for help. He's intervening in the ways that he thinks are reasonable in light of your presentation. Okay, taking your health history doesn't require consent. The admission to a hospital or other facility doesn't require consent. If it's needed, you get to go. If it's not needed, you're not going to be sent. Okay, personal assistance services, these are the soft sides of personal care. This only applies if you are a patient in a long-term care facility. Okay, and so you may have, for instance, plans of care that require you to have amino baths because you've got a skin condition. Okay, it's not very intrusive. You know, some people might think it's almost a cosmetic application of cream. But in fact, because it's being done for an underlying healthcare reason, it's seen to be a personal needs assistance service. And again, if the person isn't able to weigh up the risk of going without that special bath or with it, then the substitute decision maker may make the decision for them. A treatment in a circumstance poses little or no risk of harm to the person. Somebody who's prone to headaches and can come and tell you that they want an aspirin, and they've had it in the past, there's no allergy, they're not abusing it, they're asking it appropriately, you clearly see signs, their head's aching, their face is all pinched. You know, that person, you don't need informed consent if you know it's a safe treatment and something the person uses regularly. Now the same sort of thing for cough syrups, you know, the incidental, low-risk stuff. If you believe the person isn't at risk from the treatment, there's some benefit to it. The low test stuff, you can probably get away with. And again, you don't need informed consent to do a capacity assessment under the Substitute Decisions Act or the Health Care Consent Act. In fact, as we learn about informed consent, you're going to see it's a very high threshold test, and many people who require assessments could never get that high. So it would be a tautology. You'd never be able to do an assessment if you set that bar that high. This is the information that the legislation says sets out the hallmarks for what it means to be capable for treatment. understand the information, appreciate the consequences. It's a dialogue, you know, you tell somebody something and then you listen to what they have to say about it, or you ask them to repeat it back to you to see if they in fact took it in. Again, it's the health practitioner who needs informed consent. If the person's incapable, then we're going to talk about who gets to decide. Any substitute decision maker under the legislation must be 16 years of age, must be themselves capable for the decision, must be willing to make the decision, and available in a time reasonable for the decision. Now again, time reasonable for the decision can vary depending on the intensity of the problem. May be related by birth, marriage, or adoption, so stepmoms get to decide. No, adopted children get to decide for their parents if they're over 16. Equally ranked substitutes. Brothers and sisters have to agree if they're the highest ranked and you've got two brothers and one sister. They must agree. They're all equally ranked in terms of the right to decide, but they must agree on the decision within a time reasonable. A physician or a dentist can't implement a yes or no. Pull the teeth, don't pull the teeth. And they can't sit there and squabble about it forever. If the tooth's infected, it needs to happen. You've got to get unanimity, or there's a default. It's a cognitive test. This has to do with your ability to think and weigh up and apply information to your situation. It is a person-environment fit. What does this person need to be able to take in and understand to meet their needs today? And your needs and my needs could be different given our health status, our age, all kinds of things. But remember, it's about enshrining your autonomy. We all get to decide. You can go bungee jumping if you want to. Okay? But the question is always, does the level of the decision, you know, the ability to make the decision, match the person's, the demands on the person for a decision? Let me put it this way. Some of your clients with their intellectual handicap would have a very difficult time getting to the threshold level of understanding of something as complex as a plan for chemotherapy. I mean, I would suggest to you that most of us would be struggling with it, especially under that kind of emotional turmoil. So when the decision is very complex, high risk, low benefit, the amount of capacity any of us needs goes up. If it's a low task, high benefit, low risk decision, the scale goes down. Most of us could decide about the aspirin for the headache. Okay, so keep that in mind. This isn't a point on the scale. It's a point that shifts with the individual, with their needs, with what the complexity of the decision is, what the risk is associated with the decision of yes or no. This is the one that I think, you know, the tattoo on the arm. If you can't memorize it, tattoo it, because this is what you need to know. The legislation says if a person cannot make the decision for themselves in the healthcare area, and if they can't decide about who's going to get their healthcare information, this is who's going to decide, because the two acts use the same schedule. I'm going to deal with the top three in a little more detail, but they're all legal appointments. They all have a paper associated with them that sets out the authority for the substitute. Okay, so you want to look at those documents to see what, if any, limitations are in them. And on the personal care side, when you're capable, and you decide who's going to decide for you if you end up in St. Mike's tonight, you can also put in wishes or restrictions about treatments you do or do not want. So there may be no incapable wishes in these documents, and health practitioners need to know about them in order to respect them. And they have great weight in law. If you haven't done the power of attorney and these other three don't apply to you, then this is who's going to decide. Your spouse, if you have one, or a common law spouse, or a partner. And partner is defined as two people who live together and have primary importance in each other's lives. For instance, it may be two sisters that have always lived together. And their three brothers don't get to decide because they've cohabited and been primary supports for each other. The sister would be the partner of the one who now needs decisions. and the three brothers would be lower ranked. Parent relative access, again, this applies mainly for children, and the parent, the custodial parent ranks above those who only have right of access. Brothers or sisters, and remember, these are rungs. Okay, so parents and adult children sit on the same rung, which is a little scary when you think of it. Your 18-year-old son and your 68-year mother could be deciding about what treatment you should get. You can imagine how that might give rise to conflict. Brothers or sisters, again, there's no primogeniture here. Sons don't get to go ahead of daughters by law. Again, it's a cultural problem, but the solution is, remember I said every person had to be willing? So the sisters just refuse. The brother stays up. So there's room for the cultural sensitivity to be respected as long as all the players do what is culturally appropriate. And then if there's no other relative, these could be sister-in-laws, cousins, seven removed. If there's nobody, then the last resort is the treatment decision unit at the public guardian's office. This is a very special unit. It was only created in 95. They never had authority to make decisions about personal care before. This is what I did for about 6 or 7 years when the legislation first came into being. And we would get calls every day from physicians, people out in the community who, you know, health providers in the community, saying that somebody needed a treatment and there was no family. This is the effort they'd made to locate family. This is who had found the person capable, and this is a proposal for treatment. We would go over the risks and benefits and try and collect some background information. And eventually we'd make the decision to say yes or no to whatever the treatment proposals were. This will apply to a lot of your clients. I would think you have a lot of people who don't have family members. So, and again, for any of your clients, I strongly recommend that you adopt a policy of having a cover sheet within your file that has the essential medical information on it. Their age, their height, their any known allergies, whether or not they've had vaccines, any previous surgeries, you know, all this kind of historical stuff. Family members know this because you've known the person through the course of their life. If you need to go to the public guardian's office to get a treatment decision and they've never heard of this person before, somebody's got to tell them this information. Okay, so put it together, put it on the front sheet, say what efforts have been made to find family, what you're relying on to understand that there's no family willing. Contact an Uncle Joe. Uncle Joe refuses to be involved. What date did you contact him at what number? Public guardians may still want to go and talk to Uncle Joe to see if Uncle Joe knows anything about this person. Okay, so put that stuff all together, make a few copies of it, and every time a worker is taking a client to a doctor's office or a clinic or whatever, take a copy of it with you, because when the doctor or the dentist is sitting there talking to them about what needs to happen, if they conclude the person isn't capable of making the decision, you want to be able to hand them this paper and say, this is who's this person's substitute. You need to call there for the decision. Okay, so facilitate the process. Make it work well. Yes, what happens if you've got a child in a long-term care, in a group home, there's been an assessment, the child is capable in four areas of personal care, but incapable in two. Who gets to decide about safety and, say, medical care? Well, again, according to this list, who gets to decide depends. If the client at some point did a power of attorney for personal care, then whoever is named in the document gets to decide. If there's no power of attorney for personal care, then it's whoever's highest ranked here, and in this case, it's probably the parent who gets to decide. Now, the thing I want to distinguish here, in the personal care areas, there is a difference between being incapable and having a substitute decision maker who makes a decision about where the child should live. However, the reason personal care is a lot messier than property, you can take the money and put it in a bank account, but you can't take the person and put them in a group home and have them stay there as long as they can vote with their feet to leave. You know, you can say, I want my son to be dressed in this kind of clothing every day, but if he tears it off and throws it away, what are you going to do? Okay, so on the personal care side, it is always going to be about building a carrot. What does the person want? How can we make it so pleasant, enjoyable, so consistent with what he wants that we're not piping water uphill? Okay, because you're always going to get to the compliance piece. How do you get somebody to do something day in and day out if they really don't want to do it? You know, and so you've got a decision maker who says, I want my son to have A, B, and C. You've got frontline staff who try to get son to do A, B, and C. It's in the care plan. But son votes with his feet or takes the clothes off or refuses to eat that macaroni dish one more time or whatever. There's no solution in law. It is in personal skills and personal relationships and problem solving and clinical piece. We're not going to fix the problems of interrelationships, of people being able to say, I don't want that. We don't remove their voice because we find them incapable to thoughtfully apply the information to their decision. And we don't empower the substitute to use a club. There are no sticks in law. There are only soft feathered carrots that have to be wielded with great skill and finesse. We're going to talk about the top three on this list. Guardianship. Very expensive. I've heard anywhere from $15,000 to $25,000 to go to court to become a guardian for personal care. It requires lawyers. It usually requires at least two capacity assessments. They have to give notice to a whole lot of people, so they send process servers out at $100 an hour to serve every family member who is a party to the proceeding. Very, very costly. Pie in the sky for most families. We don't need them most of the time. Worst case scenarios may need it, but they really have to be pretty compelling because the law is very clear. It's Section 55 of the Substitute Decisions Act. A court will not appoint a guardian for personal care unless they're satisfied that nothing short of a guardian will affect the change to improve the person's quality of life and that somehow with a guardian they will have a better quality of life than they have without. Okay, so sometimes I can give you a scenario where you have, again, these are some that I've seen, elderly spouse who is a primary caregiver for his wife who's had a stroke and is diabetic. He becomes very paranoid, refuses to let caregivers in. Her care needs cannot be met by him alone. People try to get, you know, they use all their clinical skills to try and reason with him, to get him to let the person in to give the needle for the diabetic. And he refuses, and he's adamant about it, and threatens them with a shotgun if they don't get off his property. Those are the kinds of scenarios where somebody may go to court, get the court to order his removal for assessment, and get in to get out her to give her what she needs. And it's a court-ordered document. The court can put restrictions or limitations on what they award decision-making for. So you need to read it. Again, this is the end of the rainbow. It's the wrong end of the rainbow. You don't want to go here if you don't have to. Okay, and because of these other things, because we're going to talk about this, the test of appointing a power of attorney for personal care is deliberately set very low. And because it's so low, many of your clients could do a power of attorney for personal care. It's a very low test. And it allows them to express their autonomy through any period of subsequent incapacity. Again, the Health Care Consent Act, even if they don't do a power of attorney, there's all this rank order of other people who could decide for them about treatment. The informal support. If you offered to do something to help somebody fill their hole, I often think people, we're all like donuts. You know, we've got fabric, but we've got holes. We need a hairdresser. We need a dentist. We need all these people to plug our holes. And we all have different shaped holes. And as we get older, the holes get a little bigger. Again, for some of your folks, their hole might have been pretty big right from the beginning. Okay, so what needs to go in that hole to ensure that they're safe and happy and well-fed and all the rest of it? And again, those informal supports, where they're offered and they meet what the person wants, it's delivered in a shape or a size or a color that the person likes, is usually accepted. And, you know, on the small stuff, we don't worry about capacity. Do they want Colgate or Crest? Who cares? Okay? Don't fight about the small stuff. Get them what they want. options for personal care. This is the legal test. There's a reference to a booklet that's been provided by the Alzheimer's Society. They can be downloaded from the internet. You can get them free by calling the Alzheimer's Society. And I really like these booklets because I like the level of language in them. They are meant to be used with seniors, so the level of language has been adjusted downward. It's a thoughtful explanation. It's a tangible thing. And again, some people who are cognitively very, have some cognitive limitations are often very concrete. Having a booklet to read really helps ground the conversation as opposed to just doing the abstract stuff. Okay, and I like that booklet because of the level of language in it. This law I mentioned is Ontario law. There are a lot of packets in drugstores that are national. They aren't necessarily accurate for Ontario law and wouldn't be valid. There are valid kits available on the Public Guardian and Trustees website. There are a lot of other brochures there, but I strongly recommend you visit that site and make yourself familiar with some of the brochures. But again, the reason we want people to do this has the ability to understand whether the attorney has a genuine concern for the welfare. How many of you deal with very limited clients who can immediately light up like a rainbow when somebody in their family comes through the door that they clearly recognize, they're clearly pleased to see them, okay, and they have very limited verbal skills, but they can recognize this person consistently. And if you spent time going through what a power of attorney is, here's a piece of paper. If you sign this piece of paper, it means your mom's going to be your decision maker always. It means when you go to the doctor and he needs to do surgery and you can't say yes or no, mom will. Or mom will decide yes or no. Okay, so get the level of language down and explain it. But I think a lot of your clients still have this option if they have somebody in their life that they clearly trust. As I say, it's their tool. For any of us, it's the tool to allow us to retain the decision about who decides for us if we become incapable. And to put in it, again, we're capable to do so,